While in many ways Japan remains one of the top-ranked economies in the world, stresses on the country are starting to play out in ways that have caught the attention of our next guest. Joining us on the phone from his office in Tokyo is Mike DeJong. He's editor-in-chief of Eurobiz magazine. It's a monthly publication about European trade and investment in Japan. Mike, thanks for being with us.
Hey, it's a great pleasure, Rick. Nice to talk to you.
So how did an editor from Toronto end up in Japan?
Well, my wife's Japanese, and we met in Toronto. She was studying English, and we had a son there, and then she wanted to move back closer to her family. And I initially got a job as a broadcaster at NHK, which is their main television network. And then from there, I've worked my way into print, and now I'm editing one of the larger English-language business magazines in Tokyo.
Huh. Now, do you have a lot of people visiting you from the States or from Canada?
Personally, no. My parents are rather aged, so they're unable to fly that far, a 12-hour flight from Toronto. But it's definitely a great place to come for a visit. I mean, you've been here a couple of times,
yeah.
Rick, so you know.
I love Japan, and I enjoy eating in Japan. I think at least as much as eating anywhere else in the world. For me, eating in Japan was one of the great travel experiences I've ever had.
That's right, and Michelin has ranked more great 5-star or 4-star restaurants in Tokyo than in Paris. Which is great for Tokyo.
Now that's something.
It's a great culinary capital for sure.
Oh, yeah. Now, we have this image of an idealized Japanese culture, delicate, understated, zen gardens, a single candle, all of this. When you're traveling around Japan today, are you able to find that?
Yeah, actually, today on the train coming in, I saw two women wearing kimonos, and you see that a lot, especially, certain times of the year, certain holidays and such, but it's a bit of a myth. It's a bit of a stereotype that we have as Westerners. I mean, it's like thinking of America as being all cowboys and horses. But still, it is surprisingly cool when you go to a sort of a historic town and you see on a Sunday, you see people wearing kimonos or carrying, the old umbrellas and stuff. So it is a real blast to the past.
But I would imagine there's a lot of pressure for the future, especially with rising economic powers on the Pacific Rim and so on. Tell us about the Prime Minister Shinzo Abe.
Yeah, Mr. Abe was elected in late 2012 and trying to turn around an economy that had suffered greatly from the Fukushima disaster, the triple disaster in March of 2011. We call it 3/11 here in Japan. And also from the Lehman shock a few years prior to that, where a lot of foreign investment left Japan for other places like Hong Kong. The problem with Japan, Rick, is it's kind of a fading power in terms of its economy compared to the rising powers in China and in India and some of these other places, Singapore. So that's one problem that the Japanese government has had to deal with. And then they had, obviously, the tragedy, which we're still 3 years later trying to rebuild from. Many people still homeless from the Fukushima area, and that's obviously requiring a lot of government investment. When Prime Minister Abe took over, he brought in a program which was dubbed Abenomics, and that was a lot of government spending, lowering the yen to try to spark a foreign investment and, make Japanese goods more attractive worldwide.
He was dealing with their crisis kind of like our government was dealing with our crisis then, stimulus spending?
That's right. And then on top of it, you had the nuclear disaster, the earthquake, tsunami, nuclear disaster that was, dropped right on top of it. So last year, it seemed the economy was picking up until the end of the year when growth kind of slowed at the end of last year. This year, it's been quite slow. And people are looking to Mr. Abe now, do you have any more rabbits you can pull out of a hat to sort of get things going? But there seems to be a bit of a malaise in the population, wondering what's going to happen next. And we'll have to see.
Now, you mentioned Japan's economy was kind of has ebbed or something like that. Is that something to do with it, a more geriatric society and a thinning population? Or to what do we attribute the fact that Japan's not the dynamo it used to be?
Well, that's exactly right, Rick. I mean, coming out of the bubble era when Japan was on top of the world almost economically, the number two economic power in the world, the bubble burst, and into the 90s they went through a great period of recession and just haven't been able to shake that off. And then again, the earthquake and tsunami hit. But you mentioned some of the demographic problems that Japan faces. They face really a demographic double whammy. They have the oldest population in the developed world. 25% of the population is over the age of 65.
Wow.
So they're retired. And then you also, at the other end of the spectrum, you have one of the lowest birth rates in the developed world. The Japanese basically aren't having babies the way they used to. So the population is, predicted to really shrink in the coming years, which is, combined with the aging of the population at the other end, it's going to put a lot of pressure on the younger generation. My son, when he reaches tax-paying age, I mean, he's probably going to be facing, you know, a horrendous tax bill just to fund all the programs that need to be funded here.
Well, to support all the retired people who are no longer contributing to the society.
That's right, and who are depending on government pensions.
Well, now, Europe has had the same problem because, I mean, my take is when you have a very successful society, it becomes better educated and wealthier, and when that happens, people have less kids and they live longer, and that just means the entitlements are going to be hard to sustain. Are Japanese accustomed to having entitlements as lavish as in Europe, or do they rely more on their families?
I think they rely more on their families than they do. I mean, they have a very good pension system and a healthcare system which covers 70%. So, you know, they do depend on that. But I think in terms of entitlements, they depend more on their companies to support them. It's not so much the government. I mean, when we all know Japanese are known to be the great workers and
very loyal.
The work ethic is... Yes, exactly. So when they become part of a company, it's almost like part of a family. So if you work for Sony or Toyota or one of these other big manufacturing companies, you know, they look to their company to support them. And in turn, they're super loyal. They basically give everything they have to working for that company.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Mike DeJohn. And Mike is the editor-in-chief of Eurobiz magazine in Japan. We're talking about trends in Japan. And Mike, when you think about people relying on their companies, I think a trend in the United States has been more aggressive expectations from shareholders at the expense of workers and pensions. And you can even find companies acing loyal workers out of their pensions in order to have better returns and have a healthier bottom line. Is that a trend or a concern among workers who have been loyal to their corporate support system in Japan?
Well, not so much. I mean, the shareholder issue is not really that much of a concern here. It's more that if you come right out of university and you get a job with one of these large companies, the expectation has been that that company will take care of you if you are loyal to them. And shareholders, you know, don't really come into the picture. But the problem is in the last decade or so, that lifetime employment guarantee has sort of gone by the wayside. And we've seen a lot of Japanese workers being laid off for the first time ever. And you know, the company is going through layoffs for the first time in history, or in post-war history anyway.
Well, so corporations are no longer as loyal to the people who have dedicated their lives working for them as they have in the past. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly right. And obviously the economy has caused that, with many of the companies struggling.
Now, when you have economic hard times, does that drive the country politically to the left or to the right? Or do you see greater tension? Or how has that affected the country's general sort of political demeanor?
Well, that's a great question, Rick, and that's exactly what we're seeing here. We're seeing sort of hard times prompting a bit of a rise in extremism. I mean, we saw it in Europe prior to World War II. We saw it in Japan prior to World War II. We're seeing sort of a rise in nationalistic sentiment here in Japan over the last couple of years. I mean, Prime Minister Abe himself is a very strong nationalist. In fact, he once wrote a book about the beauty of Japan and, you know, basically talking about politically in terms of, you know, the purity of the Japanese. And we've seen some disturbing incidents recently at a Japanese pro soccer game. Some fans put up a sign, Japanese only, in one section of the seats. And that prompted a big backlash from the league and a suspension of the team, actually.
Well, this is a big departure for Japanese because I remember, you know, in the wake of all the difficult times they had after World War II, they weren't very inclined to fly their flag, as Germany was disinclined to fly its flag also. In fact, I remember in my travels in Japan, granted a long time ago, it was frustrating for me because people wouldn't even talk politics. It just seemed like they wanted to talk about cartoons and stuff, and I just wanted to talk politics. But now people are getting more militaristic and more nationalistic?
Yes, and part of the problem is the education system here doesn't really teach history in the way that it should be taught. They really whitewash a lot of the wartime atrocities. And in fact, the kids in school, they don't really learn about them. They just gloss over them. And what they do learn about are things like Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which obviously they should. But that results, in my opinion, that results in a population that sees itself more as victims of World War II rather than perpetrators. And, you know, Rick, recently I read that Japanese are very, very into the Diary of Anne Frank. It's very popular here in Japan. And one of the reasons is, it said, is because the Japanese empathize or sympathize with Anne Frank as a victim of World War II. They see themselves more as victims rather than as perpetrators. And that's dangerous. I mean, obviously, if you don't know your history, you're doomed to repeat it.
And then drawing back to that German parallel, in Germany, on the other hand, I find their documentation centers and they're very honest and candid about their troubled and dark past in order not to let it happen again.
That's right. And it's, in my opinion, that's very smart. And that's the opposite of what the Japanese do. You go down to Okinawa, and they'll have signs there talking about how here's where the Americans invaded, and here's where the Americans did this, the Americans did that. And it's nothing about the Japanese imperial past in Okinawa, which was much worse. And it's troubling with my son being in Japanese school. He's not getting a true picture of world events.
Are people quite disturbing. Would you say, Mike, that people are quite complacent and accept what's taught to them, or is there a hunger to reach out and get a more candid look at 20th century history?
No, that's true as well. People are very complacent, and it's sort of a cultural thing stemming from the Confucian past, the Chinese influence, that people in school tend to just listen to the sensei, listen to the teacher, and follow authority.
Dai sensei, exactly. Honorable teacher. Mike, just to finish up, how would you characterize the quality of life for the working class person in Japan now? What is their working situation, their vacation situation, the situation for women?
Oh, that's a big question. I would say the quality of life here is, well, it's not as good as what certainly Europeans can expect, but even North Americans, I mean, I think they really, really work themselves to death. There's even a workplace death syndrome here where people have died from overwork, they call it. It is sad, but at the same time, I mean, the Japanese do have this great family ethic as well, and, and they really do love their, you know, their cherry blossom festivals, and they love their historical festivals, so they do take time to enjoy themselves. But it's not uncommon here for a salaryman, as they're called, to work 50, 60-hour weeks and virtually never see his family until holiday time. So I think that's one of the reasons that they've said that the Japanese don't have enough children is, you know, the husband and wife just doesn't get enough time together. So that's something that Prime Minister and the governments will have to address in the future.
I don't know if you've seen the TV series Mad Men, but I was just appalled at the treatment of women in the American workforce back in the 60s. And my sense from earlier travels in Japan is Japanese women a lot of times are treated like American women were a long time ago in America. What's your sense about women's place in the workforce?
Well, that's exactly right as well. I mean, it's a very, very tough situation here for women. There are actually more girls who go to university in Japan than boys. But when they get into the workplace, they work through their 20s, they're pretty much expected to have children and then retire. Mm-hmm. And they don't hold their jobs for them. There's no such thing as your job is held for maternity and you can come back and continue on the ladder into upper management. Japan has a very small percentage of upper managers who are women. They have one of the lowest female populations in parliament, female representations in parliament. So it is a problem. But that's also something that Prime Minister Abe has surprisingly said that he would address, that he sees that is an area of growth, that perhaps if more women are welcomed into management roles, they can take some of the pressure off the men and also have more spending power and create more growth in the economy.
It sounds like this Prime Minister Abe, is somebody to keep an eye on. Mike DeJong, Editor-in-Chief of Eurobiz magazine in Japan, thanks so much for joining us. This has been a little bit of a downer, but let's finish by reminding people Japan's a beautiful place to visit in your travels. And in spite of all their hard work and their economic challenges, let's cap this discussion with something colorful and fun that you can do in Japan that reflects a culture that is resilient and able to rebound from things like difficulties back in World War II and the more recent triple disaster at Fukushima.
Well, aside from the great cherry blossom festivals and visiting, you know, the greatest restaurants probably in the world, my favorite thing about Japan is the baseball. The baseball is just incredibly fun here. I think it's more fun than baseball in Canada and the States. And the fans really get into it, and the players are quite good, and it's a great experience for kids. So, you know, I would say to my American and Canadian friends to come here and go to a baseball game in Japan because it's like no other experience, a sporting experience that you've ever had.
Mike DeJong, if my memory serves me correctly, domo arigato would be thank you very much. Is that right?
Yes, that's it. And doitashimashite is you're welcome.
Makes me want to go back to Japan. Thanks again, Mike, and best wishes with your work at Eurobiz magazine.
Thanks very much, Rick.
Mike DeJong's been with us on the line from his office at Eurobiz magazine in Tokyo. Their website is eurobiz.jp. That's eurobiz.jp. When Jake Wargo went to Tokyo with his microphone, he decided he needed to get out of the busy city and find a more traditional way to slow down and really enjoy being in Japan.
Tokyo is a busy place. If you wanted a break, you could drive to Kyoto in about 6 hours. or hop on a bullet train in 3 hours, or if you have the time, you could walk between the imperial capitals like they used to back in Japan's feudal period on an ancient route slowly being rediscovered called the Nakasendo.
Nakasendo means the middle route through the mountains. The three characters are middle, mountain, and road.
This is Jamie.
Yes, my name is Jamie Dwyer. I am a tour leader for Walk Japan.
There's a trend happening in tourism these days towards putting the journey back into travel. It's no longer just about the destination, but how you get there. And sometimes, the slower you go, the closer you can get to the past. The Nakasendo was the superhighway of Japan's feudal era. All along the route, there are post towns where travelers would stop for the night. Today, the post towns are helping to revive the past.
Magome and Sumago and Narai, these three towns, are designated as special preservation areas, and the residents there have decided not to have any power lines, vending machines, and they try to keep cars off of the streets at certain times to retain this kind of old traditional feel of the Nakasendo.
We pass a memorial to a famous battle in 1561 when Japan was fiercely divided. A diorama explains a historic battle fought down in the valley we just walked through. Many of the towns on the Nakasendo were from a feudal past that Japan actually wanted to forget. They tore down the exclusive inns in the center of post towns where the opulent lords used to stay and built places for the people instead, often schools. But in the march of time, nothing stays the same.
What's interesting about the Honjin, or the school here, it's a haiko, a school that has gone out of business because there's no children in the countryside. The young people are basically disappearing, so once the last generation living here dies off, there's nobody left. You have a lot of open houses and, the countryside is slowly dying off.
It took caravans 2 weeks to travel the full 550 kilometers between Tokyo and Kyoto, what we did in 10 days walking and train hopping, a distance a plane can fly in about 30 minutes.
It's really the opposite of what Tokyo is. I think people, they're in need of something like this. Because in the city, you know, you may not even speak to the person who lives right next to you. Especially now, so with the younger generation, you have a lot of people who are kind of trying to go back to the country style living, a subsistence type of living. And this is a good example of, you know, how rather than starting from zero, you can see there's traditions here that allow you to live kind of a subsistence lifestyle that was present in the Edo period.
The faster you go, the less you see. Maybe it's time to slow down and take a stroll through the past before it's completely forgotten.
From somewhere along the Nakasendo in Japan, I'm Jake Warka for Travel with Rick Steves.
Jake Warga's travels include leading photography tours in Morocco. Samples of his photos and audio work are on his website. That's jakewarga.com, spelled W-A-R-G-A.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced by Tim Tatton, with Sarah McCormick and Isaac Kaplan-Wolner at Europe Through the Back Door in Edmonds, Washington. We get technical help from Andrew Wakeling and Kate Mulhern-Graham. Our theme music is by Jerry Frank. Thanks to our colleagues at KLCC Radio in Eugene, Oregon for their help this week. There's more in the radio section of ricksteves.com. You'll find links to our guests, and you can listen to any week's show again on demand. We'll look for you again next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.